Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the HJ2 Proposed Rule Task Force for Group 3, focused on information blocking and TEFCA. I'm Seth Pazinski with the HHS Assistant Secretary for Technology Policy, and I'll be serving as your designated federal officer for today's call. This meeting is open to the public, as a reminder, and we do welcome public feedback throughout the meeting, and comments can be made in the Zoom chat feature. And there will also be a scheduled time for verbal public comments towards the end of our agenda for today. So we're going to kick off our meeting with a roll call. So when I say your name, if you can please indicate that you are present, and I will start with our chair, Rochelle Prosser.
Good morning.
Good morning. Shyla Blend.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hans Butendijk.
Good morning. Sorry.
Good morning. Sooner. Yep. And we got you, Hans. Thank you. Sooner Davenport.
Present.
Derek DeYoung.
Morning.
Good morning. Steve Eichner.
Good morning.
Good morning. Lee Fleischer. And did get a message that Hannah Galvin will not be able to join us today. Dominic Mack. Anna McAllister. Katrina Miller Parrish.
Good morning.
Good morning. Chris Mork. I did see Chris on. So Chris, if you can just let us know and announce yourself. Eliel Oliveira. Rhonda Perkins.
Good morning.
Good morning. Zeynep Sumar King. Narish Sundar Rajan.
Good morning.
Good morning. Cheryl Turney.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Ray Walker.
Good morning.
Good morning. All right, thank you. Is there anyone I missed or any members who just joined that would like to indicate they are present?
Hi, this is Chris. My microphone stopped working. I am here now.
All right, thank you, Chris. All right, now please join me in welcoming our co-chair, Rochelle Prosser, for opening remarks. Rochelle, over to you.
Good morning, everyone. Can you see me?
Yes, we can see you.
Yes, okay. Good morning. Welcome to the second to last high-tech meeting. It has gone, not high-tech, excuse me, the HTI2 rule interoperability for information blocking and TEFCA. Thank you so much for being here. We've had a lot of work that has been done over the last few weeks, and everyone has worked very diligently over this very large scope, especially the homework this past week to really move forward. I've had the opportunity of looking into the document, and I welcome your comments, and I look forward to the presentations today that as we talk about the administrative efforts and the updates, but most of all, TEFCA. So I thank everyone for being here. The work has been very hard, and we've been working at a feverish pace, and I look forward to hearing your feedback, remarks, and comments. Back to you.
Okay. So just a reminder on our agenda today, we are going to have a couple of short presentations. So Rachel Nelson will present on TEFCA, and Sarah McGee and Ben Dixon are going to present on the administrative updates portion of the rule. Then we'll have a brief discussion, and then we'll move into the worksheet to continue working through feedback and draft recommendations. And then we'll have our time for a public comment, and then move to next steps and to close out the meeting. We can go to the next slide. Just a reminder of our charge. So as Rochelle mentioned, we have one more meeting after this of the Group 3 group, and then we'll be coming together as a collective task force the week of Labor Day. So that'll be the September 3rd through the 5th. First year, you get a full task force meetings to finalize recommendations in preparation for the September 12th high tech meeting. We go to the next slide. As far as covering the provisions, we'll be focused on the administrative updates and the TEFCA portions today. We can go to the next slide. All right, and I will turn it over to Rachel Nelson to lead us through. Oh, Mark, are you covering the TEFCA presentation?
Yeah, I think there must have been a mix-up. I'm pretty sure I'm on tap here.
Okay, all right, thanks, Mark. Over to you.
Yeah, no problem. And Seth, just to clarify, it looked like from the agenda I have about 15 minutes to run through the slides. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay, great. Well, then I'll jump right into it. Hey, everybody. My name is Mark Nee. I'm the director of the Interoperability Division in the Office of Policy at ASTP-ONC. My pleasure to be here talking some TEFCA. My team at ASTP leads the TEFCA work, particularly the policy aspects of TEFCA. And so we are leading the work in HTI2 as well. So next slide, please. And I'm just going to go off video while I'm presenting because I get distracted, but I'll pop back on for the discussion. Okay, so we have about 15 minutes, so we'll run through this fairly quickly. This slide just provides an overview of the TEFCA proposals in Part 172. It's important to note, you know, in Part 172, because there is some language in the information blocking preamble that touches on TEFCA. So I'm not going to cover that, I don't think, in this presentation, but just important to note that distinction. As you can see, the proposal in 172 is to add a new part, 172, to the regulations to implement certain provisions related to TEFCA that will establish the qualifications necessary for an entity to receive and maintain designations as a QHIN capable of trusted exchange pursuant to TEFCA. And you can see the breakdown of the different subparts. Subpart A, you know, the basic stuff, the statutory basis, purpose, and scope. Subpart B, requirements related to qualifications to be designated as a QHIN. Subpart C is the onboarding and designation process. So that's once an application has been submitted to become a QHIN, what the onboarding and designation process looks like to make sure that that entity is able to support nationwide exchange at scale the way we need. And, you know, that process can take upwards of a year to get through. So part D, we propose the RCE and QHIN suspension rights, notice requirements for suspension, and requirements related to the effect of suspension. Subpart E covers termination. Subpart F is the appeals rights, QHIN appeal rights, and the process for filing an appeal to ASTP. And then last, subpart G is requirements related to QHIN attestation. And I'll, you know, dig a little bit deeper into each of these as we go through. You know, as far as benefits, you know, it seems like there's a couple different benefits here that we should flag. You know, that it's important for the viability of TEFCA, what we talk about here, and TEFCA moving forward. Obviously, ONC or ASTP-ONC has invested a lot of time and effort into developing the TEFCA framework. We started working on it when the Cures Act passed in 2016 and been working hard on it ever since. And we want to make sure that we are doing everything we can to make sure that to ensure that TEFCA it lasts for a long time and is viable and keeps growing and bringing on more providers, because, you know, the only way that TEFCA will be successful is by expanding the network and bringing everyone along for the ride. Subpart G is a little bit different. It's a requirement from the Cures Act that said that in rulemaking that my office needed to establish this attestation process for QHINs, who, you know, the under TEFCA. So we'll touch on that as well. Next slide, please. Okay, here we have the statutory basis, purpose, and scope. You know, pretty straightforward. Again, a lot of the stuff I had said is just to ensure that we're taking all the steps to make sure the TEFCA is a viable product. And, you know, a lot of what is in the regulation is really focused on providing processes that are appropriate for a network of networks like TEFCA, and specifically enabling appeal rights for QHINs who feel that they may have been aggrieved or, you know, an adverse action has been taken against them by the RCE, the recognized coordinating entity. And so they would be able to have some recourse through TEFCA as appeal processes. But in order to establish the appeal processes, we needed to also establish in regulation the underlying processes for designation, suspension, and termination. So that's really what's covered here, along with, as I said, the attestation piece, which is kind of its own thing. Next slide, please. Okay, so this is, you know, the designation as a QHIN requirements. Just one thing to note for those of you that are, you know, really looped into TEFCA is that, you know, generally TEFCA is not, hasn't been implemented in the past through notice and comment rulemaking. The common agreement and the trust exchange framework are both published in the Federal Register. But this is the first time, right, in HTI 2 that we are proposing to put in, you know, through notice and comment rulemaking provisions about TEFCA. I say that because, you know, much of the information that is included, you know, once you dig down deep into the TEFCA section is the same or pretty much the same as what's included in the common agreement and the SOPs that we have released. Obviously, we want to make sure that there's alignment there, although there's, you know, going to be some differences just based on the nature of notice and comment rulemaking versus, you know, releasing a common agreement, which is an agreement that will be signed by the RCE and each QHIN. So here, you know, I talk about the benefits for establishing the designation requirements. You know, there would be ongoing and to ensure the reliability of TEFCA exchange and that QHINs will maintain their status, promote trust in the network that these entities that are being designated as QHINs meet these, you know, requirements that we have established. All right, next slide, please. Okay, you know, a lot of words here, but, you know, these are really covering, I'm not going to get into too much in the weeds, but this is the onboarding and designation processes. So again, once an organization submits an application to the recognized coordinating entity, saying that they're interested in becoming a QHIN, they have to take certain steps within the timeframes we have on the screen and obviously in more detail in the reg text and preamble. Show that they are able to support the policies and the technical framework to exchange between QHINs and also now to support Firebase exchange as well. So these are the types of things that the RCE leads. The Sequoia project is currently the RCE, but ONC oversees everything to make sure that the policies that we have chosen are being implemented and that an entity that is designated as a QHIN is able to meet our expectations for nationwide exchange. Next slide, please. Okay, suspension. So in 172.401, we propose provisions related to ASTP or the RCE to suspend a QHIN or direct a suspension of a participant or sub-participant. One thing to note here is that generally the provisions in this proposed rule related to TEFCA apply to QHINs and not necessarily to the participants and sub-participants, because the way that TEFCA is structured is that ONC is kind of at the top setting the overall policy direction. We have a contract with a recognized coordinating entity who works on implementation and overseeing application process, onboarding, designation, and some of these other maintenance issues that, and making sure that the QHINs are doing what they're supposed to be doing. But generally, the network, the way TEFCA is structured, there's each network, each QHIN is able to, make agreements with their customer base, which we call participants and sub-participants, and they manage their own network. So it didn't make sense, and it wasn't really in line with the Cures language to expand the this language in the regulation to participants and sub-participants generally. And also, obviously, there would be a resources issue as well. So so here we have a discussion of suspension, and just a note here that suspension does cover potentially a suspension of a participant or sub-participant. Next slide, please. Okay, here's termination provisions. Again, they align closely with the common agreement. Suspension generally would, as we talked about in the rule, it deals with potential risk to the network. And in the proposed rule, we go through the reasons why an entity could be terminated as well. And, built in throughout this is that there has to be appropriate process in place to implement TEFCA. And, the benefits throughout for, termination and suspension and designation is to increase trust, but it was specific to termination by swiftly taking action to remove a non-compliant QHIN and ensure that entities that fail to meet their obligations as QHINs are no longer able to act as QHINs under the TEFCA framework. Next slide, please. All right, so here is the section on review of RCE or ASTP decisions. We propose provisions to establish ASTP's authority to review RCE determinations, policies and actions, as well as procedures for exercising such review. Throughout the regulation, you'll see that there's language that makes it clear that ONC has oversight over the entire TEFCA program and makes ultimate decisions and works closely with the RCE, who is working on implementing a lot of the policies that ONC has established. There's lots of details in the regulation about the method and timing for filing an appeal. We propose that an appeal would not stay a suspension or termination, meaning that the suspension or termination would continue even if an appeal was filed. We also talk about assignment of a hearing officer and the requirements related to adjudication. Obviously there's a lot of process built in that's necessary here. The benefits, again, is just providing enough process and timing and details about what this whole thing is going to look like to ensure that there is this trust and oversight in the TEFCA network, that entities that are joining, either as a QHIN, a participant, or sub-participant, can trust that they understand the rules of the road, and they trust that if they are responding to a query, that they know where it's going and they know how it's going to be used. Next slide, please. Okay, and it looks like I'm doing pretty well on time. This last section is the QHIN attestation. So like I said, this is really from a Cures Act requirement that we have this attestation for the adoption of the Trust Exchange Framework and Common Agreement. In 172.701, we propose attestation submission requirements for QHINs and review and acceptance processes that ASTP will follow for TEFCA attestation. So, again, very procedural language here that goes into what is required to submit and then for the review and acceptance to be put on the attestation list. And then in 702, we propose the requirements for the QHIN directory, which, not to be confused with the RCE directory, this QHIN directory is distinct for the QHIN attestation list. But again, for those looped in on TEFCA, there is a QHIN directory, which is essentially the RCE directory, which is managed by the Sequoia project, which is essentially the phone book for TEFCA, but that is a different thing. And then in 172.605, we proposed provisions related to the assignment of a hearing officer. So I think that might be an error there, but because that doesn't apply to 702. So apologies for that. Yeah, and we believe that these submission procedures will support a consistent and transparent QHIN attestation process. Bottom line is we want everything with TEFCA to build trust and buy-in from industry and from different communities, that they understand what we're doing with TEFCA. They believe that TEFCA is driving health information exchange in the right direction, and that we've built in process to ensure that things are being done right. And if by some chance, or not by some chance, but if there is a situation where something goes wrong, you know, and, you know, there's a risk to the network and suspension might need to be considered, or, you know, termination might need to happen, that we have the processes in place that are transparent and consistent to make sure that that trust continues, even if, you know, obviously these things happen when you're dealing with health information exchange at scale nationwide. Next slide, please. All right, I think I fit in all in the amount of time, so I'll pass it back to you, Seth.
yeah, I see Katrina, you have your hand up. You wanna, we will have some discussion, but if you wanna go forward with your question and then we'll transition to the next presentation.
Is that okay?
Yeah,
my
go ahead.
I have actually multiple, but I'll just ask the one, which is, I'm just wondering what was already in place that this is replacing. I know you said that the common agreement and something else were in the Federal Register, but like, since we already know we have QHINs in place, what did they go through and how does that reflect what you've been presenting?
Yeah, it's a great question, Katrina. So really what I would say, and you know, I think we say throughout the preamble in the proposed rule, is that this regulation language related to TEFCA is focused on the appeal rights. But in order, so if a QHIN, if an entity applies to become a QHIN and is not designated for a certain reason, or if they are a QHIN and they are suspended or terminated by most likely the RCE, but it could be ONC, then that they are have processes in place to ensure that they can say, I think that decision, I want a review of that decision by ONC to make sure that it was appropriate. So it's really building that trust. But if you think about it, in order to implement those appeal rights, you have to have the underlying processes established as well. And so that's where what I was talking about, the processes really are leveraged from the common agreement. If you compare them and the SOPs, like it's a lot of the same stuff, but it's just ensuring that there's enough explanation and transparency about what the underlying processes are that would lead into a potential appeal.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Sure.
All right, thank you, Katrina. Thanks, Mark. So we're going to move over to Sarah and Ben for the administrative updates presentation.
All righty, so I will start it off in this section just with the admin updates. And so we'll start it off next slide. And so the first one that we have up is the definition of a serious risk to public health. Now this one, we just wanted to outline, it's not an exhaustive list, but it's a bunch of different scenarios that we think it's just a line that that actors shouldn't go toward, or just what would be something that would qualify as a serious risk to public health. Now, there are a multitude of things that could occur that would qualify as a serious risk to public health or safety. But we just wanted to give some certainty and some understanding of what situations may cause you to get there and why, or just to give sort of an outline of what is like dangerous and you shouldn't really get even close to it. So something that should never occur. And just to sort of give some understanding to developers out there of what they are. And just, I think the key thing to take away from it is that these are examples that that should be a help to you to steer away from these situations as much as possible. But it's not an exhaustive list. So that's essentially what we're going for, just get more understanding and sort of give more information, but not, obviously you can't give an exhaustive list of something like this, but to give you more understanding. So next slide, and I will toss it over to my friend Sarah.
Thanks, Ben. Good morning, everyone. So this proposal, we propose to update the surveillance requirements for ONC ACBs, specifically regarding certain maintenance of certification requirements. We propose to expand their responsibilities and to report their surveillance activities to us, and also engage with the developers to, remedy their nonconformities with regard to these maintenance of certification requirements. So to accomplish this, we also propose to add new principles of proper conduct to support these surveillance responsibilities. And we have also revised the CAP corrective action plan requirements in our regulations to be more tailored to certain types of nonconformities. And we think the benefits of this proposal are promoting program efficiency and helping the developers to maintain, and when there is a nonconformity, to regain conformity with our requirements. Next slide, please. And this proposal goes sort of hand in hand with the previous one. We do propose to update our direct review procedures to align with our proposals in 175.56. And we also propose to revise the corrective action plan requirements to add some flexibility. And we also propose procedural provisions and rewording throughout just to clarify our responsibilities. And we, again, believe these proposals would enhance efficiencies and also make clear the responsibilities of the national coordinator. Next slide. All right, that's it.
Mark and Ben and Sarah for this wonderful overview. Can everyone hear me?
You're coming a little garbled.
I'm coming perfect. Okay, hold on 1 minute.
I just did. Are you able to hear me better now?
Yes, so we can hear you now.
Okay, all right. Thank you, everyone, Mark and Ben and Sarah, for that wonderful discussion. At this time, we will open the floor to the group to discuss what was presented and hear the feedback. I know that there was some early feedback from Hannah about the earlier part of the HL7 rules. And I just wanted to open the floor to the rest of the committee for any feedback that they may have.
And Katrina I see Katrina has her hand raised. Do you want to go ahead?
Sure, and I'll ask one question. I have one more, but I'll get back in the queue. For the termination piece, and apologies that I did not read the whole thing, I'm wondering if there's any mention or addressing of if a QHIN has to be terminated, is there any way that the information exchange that is being supported by that QHIN will be in some way reinstated in another way temporarily? Would it go through another QHIN? Is there any way to address sort of the dropout of that QHIN and trying to support the information exchange during that time?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't know that, sticking to what's in the rule, I don't believe that there's, if I remember correctly, specific discussion about that in the preamble. But I will say from an operational standpoint with TEFCA, I think that's definitely a consideration. I mean, a couple points. One is that, this is what I'm saying now is really, it's not included in the rule, but it's just the TEFCA program. Is that termination would be a last resort. And I think we probably say that in the rule. The idea is that these QHINs have gone through an extensive onboarding and designation process, and there's trust been built. So if an issue arises, the goal is to work it out with the QHIN and to limit disruptions as much as possible. So, termination would be an extreme situation. I think, a strength of TEFCA is also that currently we have 7 QHINs, and there's, I think, 2 or 3 right now that are getting a lot closer to becoming QHINs. And so there is understanding that there would be obvious disruption. I mean, I think there's no way to avoid it if there was a termination. There are, other options out there to transition as smoothly, I think, as possible, to ensure that there aren't those types of disruptions in the network. But we hope, and we don't anticipate termination happening very often at all. It's really, like I said, a last resort.
Agreed, and that's great, because I do see the suspension process and then moving to termination, and that would be great. But it may be something to think about, even with a voluntary removal from QHIN. There might be, something you all can sort of look at to try to support all of the constituents that are actually using it. So something to think about.
Yeah, that's a great point. Thank you for raising.
Thank you. Thank you for that great question. I actually wanted to just add to that. When a QHIN, or if they are terminated, and I know that that's the position of last resort, who owns the data? I'm actually thinking, are we thinking this through to ensure that we have things in place to ensure that for those patients that are impacted, or facilities and physicians that are impacted with this QHIN being removed, that they have access to the data that belongs to them? And then I'll open that up to the rest of the questions. Next question, please.
Oh yeah, I guess I'll address that really quickly. I mean, I think it's a really good point. I just want to be careful. I think that gets at some questions that maybe aren't totally addressed in the rule. But obviously legitimate. I think one point to clarify about kind of how QHINs function generally is that while there's no nothing to say that they can't hold the information, just based on the current QHINs and conversations we've had, generally QHINs will act as the intermediary for ensuring that the information is flowing and will not be holding the information. So as far as, who's holding the patient data, I don't know that that would generally change based on a termination. A provider or hospital system would still have the same information. What would be impacted would be their ability to exchange or request information through the network. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, it does. And it just goes to who is in control of the data. Because if we remove the mechanism for that or that intermediary bridge for the sharing of information, then the patients are on the losing end. So I think we're saying the same thing, but I'm just trying to ensure that we address it appropriately, or if we haven't thought about that we, you know, have a consideration to that. But thank you so much. Next question. Go ahead.
It's a great, and just a note, sorry to interrupt, just an overarching comment is that I think the things that you guys are thinking about are great. And I think there's other contexts, you know, this talk, I'm trying to stick specifically to what's in the proposed rule.
Sure, understood.
But within the TEFCA framework, there's lots of other documents where we address some of these issues in more detail.
Yeah, maybe we could have some clarity of saying where to point to, or some guidance from the ONC a little bit more in this case. I know we want to say that it's a point of it might never happen, but you know, never happens happen. And so we want to really make sure we think about it as we go forward and start talking about putting punitive confines around the sharing of information.
Yeah, understood.
Yeah, no problem. And who's Seth, can you let me know who's next, please?
Yes, we've got Steve Eigner. You want to go next?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. Mark, thank you so much for sharing your presentation. I do think we need to drill a little bit deeper into the issue of holding data, because there are provisions in the public health SOP that allow intermediaries to retain data for audit purposes, and presumably that includes QHINs. That's a problem from a public health data ownership perspective in the use of data that may be reported exclusively for public health purposes, and what are the other potential uses and longevity of some of that data. That's a real issue I think we need to figure out. Secondly, looking at in the event a QHIN needs to step away from action, what happens to the entities that are connected to the QN? What assistance is available to help them move to a different QN? Again, thinking about it from a public health agency perspective, if we're relying on the QN to serve as a connection point to feed us data, and suddenly that connection goes away, we're without necessary data for public health, and we can't easily transition to other data sources. Thirdly, what's the role of the patient and the individual in terms of looking at being involved in overall TEFCA management, so that if a patient or the patient community perceives there to be an issue, they have a route to influencing decision-making about paths forward? Thank you.
Yeah, so Steve, those are all great questions. I'll try to, I think I jotted down the gist of each of them. And just the, you know, I guess the same caveat I provided is that, you know, what's in the proposed rule is somewhat limited. It's really, like I said, the focus is on appeals that QHINs, the process for appeals that a QHIN might take, and, you know, what the underlying processes are that would support actions taken against a QHIN. So, you know, for your first question, public health, obviously we don't really get into any of the exchange purposes specifically in the proposed rule. Since I work on TEFCA more broadly, just to be clear, this is not in the proposed rule. I can speak to, you know, that there are other avenues that we can probably discuss this, because, you know, we are working very closely with CDC, and we just put out the public health SOP for implementation. So there's a lot going on with public health. So we'd love to talk to you more about your concerns, but probably not on this call is the right place to dig into it. As far as the QHIN, you know, I think your question was about a termination of a QHIN. Again, you know, getting into transition services and things like that is not included in this proposed rule, but there are provisions in the Common Agreement. Common Agreement version 2 is the most recent one out there. I would say that, you know, the way that the QHINs are structured, obviously, is they're big networks that have agreements with participants down the line. So, you know, based on those legal contracts that the QHINs would have with their participants, I think they would be required in some way to keep them informed if they are, you know, probably going to go out and, you know, be terminated from TAFCA. That's just speculation, but I think their, you know, their legal counsel should definitely look into, you know, their plans if you're a participating hospital or provider of what would happen if there was a termination. But there are some provisions, I believe, in the Common Agreement that address transition services, but they're more focused on the RCE and not on the QHINs, I believe. Last, I think you asked about the role of the patient in TEFCA management. You know, TEFCA really tries to focus and put the patient at the center. Again, we don't get into the patient's role in TEFCA in the proposed rule, but I'd be happy to talk more with you about, you know, how to make sure that we are putting the patient and empowering the patient through the TEFCA engagement. I mean, there are things in place that I think really support patient access and just, you know, privacy and security related to that. For instance, the notice of privacy practices for individual access services is very robust and has great provisions that ensure that the patient would be able to know how an app would be using their information through TEFCA. So things like that are built in, but happy to talk more on a separate call.
Happy to do so as well, but I do want to clarify two pieces. Number one, looking at the patient involvement piece, it's not that patient data is not being exchanged across TEFCA. It's looking at patients being positioned in the governance of TEFCA so that it's not things being done to the patient or for the patient. It's management by the patient that becomes a relevant issue. Secondly, looking at the maintenance of data or the continuity of data, if maintenance of exchange, if a QHIN were to go down, I think that is a systemic issue and ties directly to Rochelle's and other folks' questions as well. It's not unique to public health. That's just an example of where it stands. I think it may not be adequately addressed in the existing common agreement or existing framework for continuity and of exchange, and that really is a fundamental trust issue in looking at network reliability.
Yeah, no, those are fair points. At the other hand, so I'll address these really quickly. One, appreciate the clarification about, you know, that you're talking about patients and governance. That you're right, that is a different issue. And we are currently, you know, the governance is in place, but we're thinking about how to make sure that different communities and interested parties are incorporated the right way into the governance processes. So we've heard a lot of feedback. Again, just to clarify, this isn't in any way included in the proposed rule, but just speaking to your question, we've heard that, you know, the public health community should be represented, payers should be represented. So we're looking at how to go beyond in the governance structure, just representing QHINs, participants and sub-participants, but also looking at what are the communities that they represent and how can we bring them into the governance structure to make it even stronger. So I hear you when we're looking into that. Regarding the maintenance and continuity of data, yeah, it's a great point. Again, not covered in the proposed rule, but you know, there are steps in place, you know, I believe that we can talk through. But also, I don't think a termination would be something that just happened immediately. There would be, I think, a lot of notice based on what was going on And I think the QHIN would probably have some requirements to provide notice to their participating entities. But, you know, I think that would be a conversation, if you want to hear more about it, that we should have with the RCE as well, because they have been managing a lot of the implementation aspects. So, but thank you for your questions.
Thanks, Mark. Hans, you're up next.
Yeah, just a quick question. Thank you, Mark, for the updates here and trying to tease a little bit the difference between HCI2 intent, and obviously we have a lot of staff out there. And some of the questions and discussions are around access to data, where the question is it really the QHIN or is it the participant sub-participant where it applies to? From the description, the summary, I got the impression that HCI2 is mostly focusing on the QHIN, but it does reference participants and sub-participants as well. To what extent, for the questions that are being raised about access or losing access to data, are by reference to QHIN, that it actually implies the flowdowns to the participants and the sub-participants as well? Is there anything here that that you can clarify in the rule on the scope of that is currently proposed? Because that might help or clarify further where does it encompass the entire chain, or does it only encompass when we talk about suspension or the implications for access to data? Are we only talking about the QHIN itself?
Yeah, that's a great question, Hans, and I know you're very involved in TEFCA, so yeah, and I think it's a really good point. I don't want to speak in too many generalities. I would need to like go provision to provision, but I can say for the most part, the HTI2 proposed rule focuses on QHINs. It's about when a QHIN can appeal an adverse decision related to not being designated, suspension or termination, and the underlying processes that QHINs would go through to be designated and to meet the requirements of being a QHIN for exchange. I believe, just again, I would need to look in more detail, but I believe the suspension provision is really one of the only ones that gets down into the participant and sub-participant level. And the reason for that is suspension is based on an immediate kind of threat condition to the network. And from our perspective, and I think this is discussed in the preamble, those are situations when it wouldn't be adequate to just go to the QHIN level, but ONC or the RC should have the ability to step in and take immediate action to suspend an entity that is risking, or poses a risk to the privacy and security, et cetera, of the network. But besides that, I believe it's really focused on QHINs and not participants and sub-participants. We don't reference the specific documents, Hans, but the terms of participation, for those that don't know, are it's like an appendix to the common agreement that is a standalone document that can be included in between a QHIN and a participant, but generally we're talking about the common agreement and the requirements related to QHINs, not participants and sub-participants.
Thank you.
Yep.
So this is Seth, and just noted we are over time on this item and on the agenda. Yeah, we should be moving into that.
Maybe we can get together. We actually just got to Florida.
So we should be moving to the task force recommendations, but I see Cheryl and Chris have your hands raised. So if you could just make your comments, please. Let's start with Cheryl.
Okay. I actually had added a comment to the spreadsheet earlier today that really touches on this subject. And because of the fact that the rule does appear to be focusing on the QHINs and not necessarily the participants, but there is also a gap in the common agreement in terms of how to deal with bad actors, which could be a QHIN and or a participant. And the point that Steve made earlier, where the QHIN does keep PHI or PII on file as part of auditing is of concern to any organization, especially related to any kind of disclosures. So I believe Hans brought up the point of a financial, which I added to the spreadsheet, but I do think we need to have more meat and details relative to the recommendations ONC has here, because it needs to address not only the QHIN, but also the participant level.
Yeah, Cheryl, I know we're short on time, and good to hear from you. I don't know if we've talked since I was leading these sessions for information blocking years ago, so good to hear you again. A few points. One is, again, this is kind of out of scope for the proposed rule, I think, at least currently. You know, I think we can consider, obviously, comments that come in about whether there's something we should add in there. But there are provisions in the common agreement just noting that regarding turning over information if you are terminated. I don't have them in front of me, but I believe it's covered in the termination section of the common agreement. So I'd be curious, again, I don't think we have time here or it's not the right venue, but I welcome a further conversation. Feel free to reach out to me directly to talk about your concerns there. I'm not clear on whether it's related to what's in the proposed rule or whether it's something that's more broadly a comment on the TEFCA framework.
All right, thanks, Mark. Chris, did you have a last comment on this before we jump into the spreadsheet? I saw you had your hand raised.
Sure. I had to also put the question into the spreadsheet. Maybe that wasn't the right spot. I was specifically curious about the reason that a QHIN needed to be exchanging information for at least one exchange purpose, but be capable of exchanging information for all required, or be capable of exchanging the required information for all exchange purposes. You know, that be exchanging for one and be capable of it for all. And I guess my underlying concern is we know that one of the exchange purposes, the treatment exchange purpose, is going to be the most common one. And I can envision a future easily where everyone is exchanging under treatment and they claim they can do the others, but it's all kind of moot because nobody is, and we get kind of stuck on that one spot.
Yeah, it's a good question, Chris. And so I think to explain it, I think you have to take a step back to say that, you know, ideally we wanted to make all six exchange purposes have required response like off the bat. That would have been great, but that's not where the market was. You know, we heard from different groups that you can't push it too fast, and we want to try to take an approach that makes a lot of sense to what's actually we're hearing from industry. And so right now, treatment and individual access services are the ones that have a required response, and the others do not. They still can happen via TEFCA, but there's not an SOP out there to explain it. So the requirement you're talking about is you have to actually be exchanging for one, but capable of all. The idea is that these QHINs, the expectation is when everything, down the road, when all of the exchange purposes are fully implemented, all of the QHINs will have to support all of six and beyond exchange purposes. But currently, like you said, a lot of the exchange purposes haven't been fully implemented. So, this is more of a floor of a requirement. It's not, a ceiling. And I think the key here is the regulation language just sets out the floor. But if you look at actual TEFCA implementation in the SOPs, there's more information about what the expectations are as we fully implement each exchange purpose and provide the details of the use cases included in SOPs. So this should not be read as a limitation on QHINs that would be different than, you know, the TEFCA exchange. It's really just to get yourself in the door as a QHIN, but then there are additional requirements to fully to work within the fully implemented TEFCA ecosystem.
Got it, thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Rochelle, just letting you know, we have no further hands raised, so we can move into the.
Perfect. I was. Thank you so much, Seth. Before I actually begin on this document, we did discuss the overview of the administrative updates. Hans has to leave. I just wanted to hear to know if anyone had any objections or strong comments against the administrative updates. If not, I would prefer to focus on the TEFCA. And if you do have a strong objection, I would love to hear it now before Hans leaves. And if no hands are raised, then we will just focus on the TEFCA updates.
And by the way, I just got a notice that what I needed to drop for is not happening, so I can stay.
Oh, wonderful, Hans. Great. That's wonderful. Okay. Seth, do you see any raised hands regarding the administrative updates? Anyone want to speak on before we move to this?
No raised hands.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so everyone, let's begin the work of looking at the individual line items here for the rules. I want to thank our ONC presenters for their wonderful talk and the excellent and robust feedback. I did expect this to occur today. Without further ado, yes, we can see this spreadsheet. Let's begin with the comments. If you don't mind going up a little bit, Excel, to the comment section. All right, there we go. We can go through, for DM. Is that you, Dominic? If you want to take yourself off mute and just comment on the new part of the rule 172. Are you here today?
Dominic is not.
He's not here. Okay. Seth, do you mind just reading his comment and then we can discuss it lightly?
Sure. The comment is, while TEFCA recognizes the important role of QHINs in building the nation's infrastructure to securely share electronic health information, it is important that the rule sets standards that allow for alternative models and is not exclusive for other technology structures that may address information blocking.
Thank you, Seth, for that. ONC, is there a comment that you might have on that, or is that in scope or out of scope for this portion of the rule?
I would say some additional detail might be helpful there on what the question is getting at. Yeah, I think it's saying that, just to paraphrase, it seems to me that they're saying that TEFCA shouldn't lock someone into exchanging in one way, and it should enable maybe other models of exchange. But I think just a note of caution that a lot of times people conflate information blocking and TEFCA. And just to be clear, you know, information blocking is the legal framework for information sharing or legal foundations, that regulation. And TEFCA is really the pipes. It's a network of networks that enables the exchange. So yeah, I'm not totally clear what the question is asking, I'll say.
Okay, what I will do is have Dominic provide some feedback, and if necessary, I will forward that on to you, if you would be so kind. All right, yeah, thank you very much. All right, sure. Seth, if you could read the initials of the second one. I'm very sorry, I'm on my cell phone.
It's KM.
KM, so that would be Chris. Chris, is this part of the overview that you had discussed that you had mentioned in your comment earlier, that you had already notated on it? And if not, go ahead and unmute yourself and talk about your comment, please.
So I had been diving into the specifics around the thresholds that were established for keeping known or high risk or known bad actors from overwhelming a QHIN and doing bad things with the information. And so the underlying comment is that the 5% threshold, that does feel like it strikes a good balance. And I was wanting to acknowledge that a higher threshold could be defensible, especially if there were some sort of cumulative threshold in place. And that cumulative threshold, I'll jump sort of to the end of that comment, is with a 5% threshold, 11 actors working together at 4.9% shares, that gives you a controlling interest in that QHIN. Those 11 actors could compel the QHIN to do something nefarious. Whether or not that is a concern, I don't know. Just wanted to acknowledge that there is a cumulative aspect, and I appreciate that identifying such a cumulative risk is a difficulty for somebody who wants to be considered a QHIN. So I appreciate the balance of 5%. Yes, collusion could happen, but there are probably other mechanisms. I then finally wanted to acknowledge perhaps a higher threshold could be okay if a QHIN wanted to go through some sort of cumulative test. So maybe there is a 8% ownership by one of these high risk or known bad actors, but if there are no other high risk or bad actors in the system, then that's probably okay, because even at that 8%, because we've identified the inability to collude, at least among those known bad actors, I am comfortable with a higher threshold at that point.
Well, it sounds like, Chris, you talked yourself into liking the proposal, but I will say that, you know, obviously we welcome feedback and comments on you know, whether this threshold is appropriate. Like you said, we tried to strike the right balance of allowing folks in, but also having extremely strong security protections to make sure that the TEPC information is being used appropriately by the right people.
I think I still stand by recommending that you consider some sort of alternative cumulative test that would allow a QHIN to participate, even if they could not pass the 5% threshold for each individual shareholder.
Understood. Thank you.
So it's going to continue on in the Chris show for a few more comments. So Chris, do you want to, if there are no other hands on what Chris is saying, we can move to your second comment and discuss it at this time.
We've already addressed the second comment. The third comment is simply that a thumbs up, essentially saying that the ability to exchange all required information under a particular subclause 2 strikes me as what it means in fact to be required. So I think the most substantive one is the last one, which is the security requirements that I was seeing in paragraph C8 on page 63647. There were several invocations of the HIPAA security rule. So there was a request to follow certain NIST standards, 553 Rev 5, I think, in particular, paying attention to implementations that ascribed to certain HIPAA security rules. That seems to miss the case for public health when we're not talking about PHI. And I would hope that we would have security expectations nailed down in the regulations, even in those cases where HIPAA was not applying, because we had moved into a public health context where it wasn't PHI.
Yeah, so that's I see what you're saying. I'd have to look at specifically what was in the proposed rule. I can say that within the common agreement, they're in section in the terms of participation, it's section 8, but basically the security section, let me see what section is in the common agreement. Just give me one second here. Well, anyway, there's a section in the common agreement that discusses security, and I believe it addresses the question you're asking. Again, you know, there needs to be transparency and alignment between what's in the common agreement and the regulation. So I think it's, you know, fair point. I'll take a look at what the regulation language is, but I would encourage you at least to look at the common agreement as well to see if the language, you know, in there addresses your concern as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Cheryl put the link to the Sequoia project, which talks to the language and the law that you were talking about. And if you don't mind, maybe for our homework, you can provide the exact pinpoint us within the Sequoia project where we actually need to look. So I'll open it up to the rest of the group. Do you have any other comments or thoughts about this portion of section 172? And if there are no show of hands, we'll go. I'll have Axel move on to the next next portion of 172.
It looks like there are some hands. I was just going to note that in the chat, a really great resource or page. It's the Sequoia. I see someone put Cheryl put the common agreement link. What I'm putting in is the RCE's resources page. So this is updated on a rolling basis. It includes the common agreement, terms of participation. It also breaks out all of the different SOPs that have been released to this point based on exchange purpose, privacy and security, governance, et cetera. So, you know, a lot of details there. So I encourage you guys to check it out. It looks like Steve is up first, then Katrina.
Talking to myself again. Just, I did want to clarify that from a public health perspective, there are some activities that involve public health that are HIPAA-covered activities. There are some disclosures to public health that happen by HIPAA-covered entities, but the disclosure itself is not, or when public health receives the data, it's not received by a public health or a HIPAA-covered program at the public health entity. So for example, a disclosure to disease surveillance is coming from a covered provider that's not necessarily received by public health as a covered entity. However, the HIPAA language does permit and allow and support that disclosure. Backing up a little bit, looking at the earlier comment about exchange purposes and what's included. One of the difficulties, I think, looking at the way the directory currently works, and this is at the participant and sub-participant level, is that there's no requirement that the directory reflect what services or exchange purposes that particular endpoint actually supports in practice. This is a problem, especially as we look at things like public health, where the SOP currently includes three different exchange purposes or one general purpose and two subtypes. But however, if a particular public health agency isn't accepting data for a particular subtype, there's nothing indicating in the directory that they aren't receiving that data, and that could result in data being misdirected to a public health entity that's not actually receiving the data. And stepping outside of the directory service piece, there's nothing in the SOP that advises the participant or sub-participant to check with public health about what things are actually supported. Now, that last point is outside the scope of the rule, and I know it, but I just wanted to bring that up because it compounds the issues about what's not in the rule, not in the current capacity, and is something we need to address.
Yeah, so, but thank you, Steve. I guess I should call you Ike. I believe you go, do you go by Ike? Is that right?
Yes, particularly when there are multiple Steves in the room.
Okay, I like Ike, yeah. So, you know, a couple points. One, on the public health stuff, again, it's not included in the proposed rule. I just want to put out that disclaimer because I'm an attorney, to say that what I'm about to say does not affect our conversation about the proposed rule. I will say there, you know, if you look at the privacy provisions in the common agreement, there is a carve out for the privacy rule expectations that apply to non-HIPAA entities for public health authorities. Understood, like you said, that public health authorities often have two hats and could be a covered entity, could not be a covered entity. But I think that's the place you want to start to look. You may have looked there already, but I think the public health conversation is a good one, just not for this conversation here. So, you know, feel free to reach out to me, mark.nee@hhs.gov. Happy to talk more on those specifics and the SOP. on the directory, this is an important point. What Ike is talking about is not the directory that's included in the proposed rule. The directory in the proposed rule is specific to attestations for QHINs, just pretty much saying that they have been designated and providing transparency that there's a list of QHINs available on ONC's website. What Steve is, and that's the CURES requirement, what Steve or what Ike is talking about, I believe, is the RCE directory, which includes endpoints so that for fire exchange and for other exchange, you're able to understand the point-to-point transactions necessary to, or the points necessary to do point-to-point transactions, and just the phone book, again, of where everything that you need is included. So again, I think that's a good conversation to have, Steve, or Ike, but a bit out of scope for this conversation.
Thank you for this wonderful discussion. And we will certainly take these notations under consideration. Seth, who's the next person with the raised hand?
Katrina, go ahead.
Sure. And so this is what I was going to ask earlier, and I actually posted it into the spreadsheet as well, but I'll go ahead and just mention it. I think it was in 172.202. There was the mention of it didn't land there. Shoot. Okay, I'll have to update that. But anyway, 172.202, there's the mention of QHINs offering an individual access service. And I was wondering if that means a participant or a sub-participant, or if there is a definition of what it means for a QHIN to offer it.
And I'm sorry, I was just, for better or for worse, putting my email in for the hosts and panelists to reach out to me. Can you say it one more time,
okay.
Katrina?
Sure. Okay, so 172.202 mentions QHINs offering an individual access service. And I was wondering if there's a definition for offering, and if that requires that the IAS is a participant or sub-participant, or is it any IAS that's pulling data? So what that means.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I don't believe we define offer, although I know within the information blocking context, that is a definition that we put out more information on what it means to offer health IT. But within the IAS context, I think it's a good question. Just for those, you seem to be very looped in on TEFCA. So individual access services is essentially the patient access arm of TEFCA. And there's not a requirement that any QHINs provide individual access services, but they need to support individual access service exchange, meaning that they can be an individual access service provider, or they could also have, which is the more likely scenario, participants or sub-participants who provide individual access services, like an app that would be signed on to a QHIN to offer. So I think maybe I lost the question in my explanation.
So, yes, that latter part is that offering.
No. I would say no. Offering means the entity that is connecting directly with the patient to enable them to access their information. So I think the again, just disclaimer, this is not included in the proposed rule. This is a question separate from that related to TEFCA. But no, yeah, you would be offering, they would be, I think the appropriate terminology is the QHIN, if there's an app that is a participant of a QHIN, the QHIN would be supporting the exchange of individual access services by moving the information, but the app itself would be offering individual access services and would be the individual access service provider. And I would also direct you to the definitions. There's a nice glossary of terms that we have on the RC website, as well as, you know, in the common agreement, there's definitions where we have a definition of individual access service provider, I believe. So
yeah, there is. It's that offer part that I was trying to make sure was clear. And I thought it was based on the proposal that was in slide 11 for 172.202. So apologies if I'm asking the wrong question at the wrong time.
And I think it might be, Katrina, again, I can't say too much, but we welcome comments on that. If it's a point that is not clear, I think that would be a great thing to comment on and ask for clarification. Yes.
I will add it again.
Thank you, Katrina. I was looking and I'm not seeing anyone else having their hands up for that section of the rule. So if, Axel, if we can go down to the next section of Rule 172. And know that we have 3 minutes left. So I'm going to say we may have consensus on this because we don't have any comments. So I will open it up for comments very shortly. If we can go back to the rule portion to the left, Ben, please. Okay, yes, right there. Thank you. And for the purposes of this call, if I'm not seeing comments in here, it's more of a consensus. Otherwise, I'll ask Ike or Hans or Chris to comment. These are the administrative updates. Okay. All right. So we have moved to the administrative updates. I did not think we would get here this quickly, but I think we had opened this up to the floor and there were no standing disagreements with the administrative updates. So can we make this section green for the purpose of the group?
At this point, I have no objection to that. So I'm not aware of from our community any comments.
Yes.
Great.
So it
goodbye me.
Wonderful. Wonderful. All right. So if we can make the administrative update screen. There was one question that I did have, not trying to throw a fly in the ointment there. But when we were talking, there was one section that's kind of jumped out to me in the presentation of this section, and forgive me if it flew out my mind from all this wonderful conversation that we've had. And it came about a clarification point in this, and you know what, I'm just going to have to leave it for right now because it flew out of my head. And if it was just more for me understanding the point that was here for the update, but all in all, I have no objection to the updates here. So we actually,
Michelle, feel free to reach out and give me a call, sure. Or I'm happy to talk if you remember it.
Yeah. It was just, I think it was just a matter of when the clarifying point on the administrative point, what was the clarity that was behind it? Why we needed to make this more clear? It was more a semantics thing, not necessarily that something needed to change in it at all. So with that, this is great. For the 172 section above, I would like to place people responsible to start crafting the overall understanding from the group section. So is there anyone that feels that they just have to get their hands on this and want to help steer the group in coming to consensus on Rule 172?
This is Steve. I'm happy to help.
Okay. What about you, Dr. King? Is she here? Okay. Sooner, did you have anything to speak under the Indian Health portion before we go to open comments for the public?
Rochelle, this is Steve. I do have one question.
Yes.
About the TEFCA piece, and I want to get group's feedback.
Okay.
There were a bunch of items that you talked about with Mark's excellent input and support that were not in scope for the rule itself. Do we want to make note in our comments that these may be areas for ONC to or ASDP to explore in future efforts or future work? Because I think there may be a need to recognize some of those elements.
Yes, especially when it comes to the gaps and understanding that this is out of scope, but all comments are welcome. And we want to hear all positions in case that ONC or ASTP, as they were guiding the first initial pass. Remember, this is the floor, this is not the ceiling. And so we can always improve. And maybe we can send that as guidance to the ONC for clarification.
Exactly.
And what are your thoughts on that, ONC?
So just to say it back, it sounded like question about that there's some things that are out of scope here, and adding some commentary about suggesting that we should consider expanding the scope of the rule in the future. Is that the gist of it?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I guess. I'm not sure. I think obviously you guys are able to submit whatever recommendations you want. I'd say I'll give you some context that may be helpful. It's just for those who are not attorneys or not going through the regulatory process. I will note that putting things in regulation has a very specific process to it, and I would say when you're considering proposals about including more in regulation, I would probably encourage you to think about weighing the what effect that might have on the flexibility and functionality of the actual network of networks that we are implementing, and how incorporating certain provisions could affect the timing and the flexibility. But obviously, if you have comments, you should I encourage you to submit them.
Go ahead, Hans. Did you want to make a comment before we move to public comment?
I don't have any comments.
All right. Thank you, Mark, for the flexibility on that. I think that hearing from the group, there was some consensus around the ability of the QHIN to actually hold data when and there are other policies that speak to that. And so maybe there might need to be a little clarification or direction or guidance from ONC when that occurs, when we know that the QHIN has the ability to, in other law, case law, to hold data. With that, yes, go ahead.
So, real quick, Rochelle, I don't know that I'll answer the question, but just to be clear, I mean, again, outside the scope of necessary rule, but within TEFCA, there's no requirement that a QHIN does or does not hold information. They're able to if that's their business model and what they're agreeing to with their participants. My point was generally, from my understanding, most of them do not hold the information. Another key point is I believe HIPAA, I think I need to look at the specific provisions, but applicable law applies across TEFCA. So if there are HIPAA provisions that require returning information within a certain time frame, those would apply to those QHINs under the HIPAA framework.
So maybe it's just adding the provision of where applicable by law or something like that to give further guidance. Just for clarification and further guidance, just a thought.
Okay. I think something that could be good. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. All right. With that said, thank you for such a robust discussion with everyone. I will. Cheryl, can you take yourself off mute and ask that question really quick before we go to public comment?
It's not a question. This is something that we just recently verified as a payer, but QHINs that don't hold information are still required to hold audit information. And that does include, because we looked at the the output, PHI or PII about the transaction. So that's also information that we as payers would be concerned about, Mark, and I'm sure other participants would too. It's not the same degree, it's not all the EHI, but it is a part of the EHI.
Yeah, and Cheryl, I think these are good points. Again, probably like you said, some of these, we should have calls. I'm happy to be involved with Sequoia, but I think as you, it sounds like you know, we are currently working on building out the healthcare operations. You know, the SOP was released, but we're trying to actually implement it. We're working on the 10 by 10, we're calling it. That's essentially an early demonstration or pilot. So I think some of these issues that you're raising would be great things to flag as we try to, you know, work towards implementing healthcare operations and payments in the next, you know, coming months and year.
Understood. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. And with that, we will close our discussion period and move to public comment. And Seth, if you would like to take over.
Yeah, thanks, Rochelle. So we're going to open up the meeting for public comment. If you are on the Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the raise hand function, which is located on your Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you're participating by phone only today, you can press *9 to raise your hand. And then once called upon, press *6 to mute and unmute your line. And as we give folks a few seconds to queue up with any public comments, just a reminder for everyone that the final Group 3 meeting for the HTI2 Task Force will be on August 29th from 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time next week. And then after that meeting, we'll be moving to having full HTI2 Task Force meetings the week of Labor Day from September 3rd through September 5th. And then finally, just a reminder to everyone that all the meetings from today and all our high-tech meetings can be found on healthit.gov. So I'm not seeing any raised hands on the Zoom, and I see from Asel, we do not have any comments on the line. So I will turn it back, Rochelle, to you to go over next steps and to close this out.
Well, thank you everyone for coming and for this wonderful, wonderful discussion about TEFCA and the administrative updates. Our upcoming meeting will be 8:29 and that will be the last one to be able to provide your input and your thoughts on the on this HTI information blocking and TEFCA portion of the rule before we send it on and have the full committee meetings on September 3rd, 4th, and 5th. After that, on the 12th, we will deliver our recommendations to the HITECH committee. Next slide, please. And with that, I really welcome the further discussions and hearing how we will move forward to finalizing the recommendations. And if there is nothing else on the agenda, I will move to adjourn, Seth.
All right. Thank you all. We will close the meeting. Have a great rest of the day.